front to rest against his chest, the other up his back. The faded whip marks felt like threads under his skin. He laid his hand against mine, pressing it tight against his chest. He was very warm, and his heart beat slow and strong under my fingers.
"Sleep a kneeing down," he said. "I will na let ye freeze."
I woke abruptly from a chilly doze, with Jamie's hand squeezing my thigh. "Hush," he said softly. Our tiny shelter was still dim, but the quality of the light had changed. It was morning. We were covered over with a thick blanket of snow that blocked the daylight, but the faint otherworldly quality of the night's darkness had vanished. The silence had vanished, too. Sounds from outside were muffled but audible. I heard what Jamie had heard, a faint echo of voices, and jerked up in excitement. "Hush," he said again, in a fierce whisper, and squeezed my leg harder. The voices were drawing closer, and it became almost possible to pick out words. Almost. Strain as I might, I could make no sense of what was being said. Then I realized that it was because they weren't speaking any language I recognized. Indians. It was an Indian tongue. But I thought the language wasn't Tuscarora, even though I couldn't yet make out words. The rise and fall was similar, but the rhythm was somehow different. I brushed the hair out of my eyes, feeling torn in two directions. Here was the help we so badly needed. By the sound of it, there were several men in the party, enough to move Jamie safely. On the other hand, did we really want to attract the attention of a band of unfamiliar Indians who might be raiders? Rather plainly, we didn't, judging from Jamie's attitude. He had managed to lift himself on one elbow, and he had his knife drawn, ready in his right hand. He scratched his stubbled chin absently with the point as he tilted his head to listen more intently to the approaching voices. A clump of snow fell from the framework of our cage, landing on my head with a little plop and making me start. The movement loosened more snow, which poured inward in a glittering cascade, dusting Jamie's head and shoulders with fine white powder. His fingers were gripping my leg hard enough to leave bruises, but I didn't move or make a sound. A patch of snow had fallen from the latticework of hemlock branches, leaving numerous small spaces through which I could see out between the needles, peering over Jamie's shoulder. The ground sloped a little away from us, falling a few feet to the level of the grove where I had cut branches the night before. Everything was thick with snow. A good 4 inches must have fallen during the night. It was just past dawn, and the rising sun painted the black trees with coruscations of red and gold, striking white glare from the icy sweep of snow below. The wind had come up in the wake of the storm. Loose snow blew off the branches in drifting clouds like smoke. The Indians were on the other side of the grove. I could hear the voices plainly now, arguing about something from the sound of it. A sudden thought raised goose flesh on my arms. If they came through the grove, they might see the hacked branches where I had chopped limbs from the hemlocks. I hadn't been neat. There would be needles and bits of bark scattered all over the ground. Would enough snow have trickled through the branches to cover my awkward spoor? A flash of movement showed in the trees, then another, and suddenly they were there, materializing out of a hemlock grove like dragon's teeth sprung from the snow. They were dressed for winter travel, in fur and leather, some with cloaks or cloth coats atop their leggings and soft boots. They all carried bundles of blankets and provisions, had headpieces made of fur, and most had snowshoes slung across their shoulders. Evidently the snow here wasn't deep enough to render them necessary. They were armed. I could see a few muskets, and tomahawks or war clubs hung at every belt. 6, 7, 8. I counted silently as they came out of the trees in single file, each man treading in the prints of the one before him. One near the back called out something, half-laughing, and a man near the front replied over his shoulder, his words lost in the blowing veil of snow and wind. I drew a deep breath. I could smell Jamie's scent, a sharp tinge of fresh sweat above his normal musky sleep smell. I was sweating too, in spite of the cold. Did they have dogs? Could they sniff us out, hidden as we were beneath the sharp reek of spruce and hemlock? Then I realized that the wind must be toward us, carrying the sound of their voices. No, even dogs wouldn't scent us. But would they see the branches that framed our den? Even as I wondered this, a large patch of snow slid off with a rush, landing with a soft thump outside. Jamie drew in his breath sharply, and I leaned over his shoulder, staring. The last man had come out of the gap in the trees, an arm across his face to shield it from the blowing snow. He was a Jesuit. He wore a short cape of bearskin over his habit, leather leggings and moccasins under it. But he had black skirts, kilted up for walking in the snow, and a wide, flat, black priest's hat, held on with one hand against the wind. His face, when he showed it, was blonde-bearded, and so fair-skinned that I could see the redness of his cheeks and nose, even at such a distance. "Call them," I whispered, leaning close to Jamie's ear. "They're Christians. They must be, to have a priest with them. They won't hurt us." He shook his head slowly, not taking his eyes off the file of men, now vanishing from our view behind a snow-topped outcropping. "No," he said, half under his breath. "No. Christians they may be, but..." He shook his head again, more decidedly. "No." There was no arguing with him. I rolled my eyes in mingled frustration and resignation. "How's your back?" He stretched gingerly and halted abruptly in mid-motion with a strangled cry as though he'd been skewered. "Not so good, I said, sympathy well laced with sarcasm. He gave me a dirty look, eased himself very slowly back into his bed of crushed leaves, and shut his eyes with a sigh. "You have, of course, thought of some ingenious way of getting down the mountain, I imagine," I said politely. He opened one eye. "No," he said, and shut it again. He breathed quietly, his chest rising and falling gently under his fringed hunting shirt, giving a brilliant impression of a man with nothing on his mind but his hair. It was a cold day, but a bright one, and the sun was jabbing brilliant fingers of light into our erstwhile sanctum, making little blobs of snow drop like falling sugar plums around us. I scooped up one of these and gently decanted it into the neck of his shirt. He drew in his breath through his teeth with a sharp hiss, opened his eyes, and regarded me coldly. "I was thinking," he informed me. "Oh, sorry to interrupt, then." I eased myself down beside him, pulling the tangled cloaks up over us. The wind was beginning to lace through the holes in our shelter, and it occurred to me that he'd been quite right about the sheltering effects of snow. Only there wasn't going to be any snow falling tonight, I didn't think. Then there was the little matter of food to be considered. My stomach had been making subdued protests for some time, and Jamie's now voiced its much louder objections. He squinted censoriously down his long, straight nose at the offender. "Hush," he said, reprovingly in Gaelic, and cast his eyes upward. At last he sighed and looked at me. "Well, then," he said, "you'd best wait a bit to be sure yon savages are well away. Then you'll go down to the cabin."
"I don't know where it is."
He made a small noise of exasperation.
"How did you find me?"
"Tracked you," I said, with a certain amount of pride. I glanced through the needles at the blowing wilderness outside. "I don't suppose I can do it in reverse, though."
"Oh."
He looked mildly impressed.
"Well, that was very resourceful of you, Sassenach. Dunna worry, though. I can tell you how to go, to find your way back."
"Right. And then what?" He shrugged one shoulder. The bit of snow had melted, running down his chest, dampening his shirt, and leaving a tiny pool of clear water standing in the hollow of his throat.
"Bring me back a bit of food and a blanket, I should be able to move in a few days.
Leave you here?
I glared at him, my turn to be exasperated.
I'll be all right, he said mildly. You'll be eaten by wolves. Oh, I shouldn't have think so, he said casually. They'll be busy with the elk, most likely.
What elk?
He nodded toward the hemlock grove.
The one I shot yesterday. I took it in the neck, but the shot didn't quite kill it at once. It ran through there. I was following it when I hurt myself.
He rubbed a hand over the copper and silver bristles on his chin.
I kind of think it went far. I suppose the snow must have covered the carcass, else our wee friends would have seen it coming from that direction.
So you've shot an elk, which is going to draw wolves like flies, and you propose to lie here in the freezing cold waiting for them?
I suppose you think by the time they get round to the second course, you'll be so numb you won't notice when they start gnawing on your feet.
Don't shout, he said. The savages might not be so far away yet.
I was drawing breath for further remarks on the subject when he stopped me, putting his hand up to caress my cheek.
Claire,
he said gently,
you canna move me. There's nothing else to do.
There is, I said, repressing a quaver in my voice. I'll stay with you. I'll bring you blankets and food, but I'm not leaving you up here alone. I'll bring wood, and we'll make a fire.
There's no need. I can manage,
he insisted. I can't, I said, between my teeth. I remembered all too well what it had been like in the cabin during those empty, suffocating hours of waiting. Freezing my ass off in the snow for several days wasn't at all an appealing prospect, but it was better than the alternative. He saw I meant it, and smiled.
Well, then, you might bring some whiskey, too, if there's any left.
It's half a bottle, I said, feeling happier. I'll bring it. He got an arm around me and pulled me into the curve of his shoulder. In spite of the howling wind outside, it was actually reasonably cozy under the cloaks, snuggled tight against him. His skin smelled warm and slightly salty, and I couldn't resist raising my head and putting my lips to the damp hollow of his throat.
Ah, he said, shivering. Don't do that.
You don't like it?
No, I dinna like it. How could I? Makes my skin crawl.
Well, I like it, I protested.
He looked at me in amazement.
You do?
Oh, yes, I assured him. I'd dearly love to have you nibble on my neck.
He narrowed one eye and squinted dubiously at me. Then he reached up, took me delicately by the ear, and drew my head down, turning my face to the side. He flicked his tongue gently at the base of my throat, then lifted his head and set his teeth very softly in the tender flesh at the side of my neck.
"Ooh,"
I said, and shivered uncontrollably. He let go, looking at me in astonishment.
"I'll be damned," he said. "You do like it. You've gone all goose-flesh, and your nipples are as hard as spring cherries."
He passed a hand lightly over my breast. I hadn't bothered with my makeshift brassiere when I dressed for my impromptu expedition.
"Told you," I said, blushing slightly. "I suppose one of my ancestresses was bitten by a vampire or something."
"A what?"
He looked quite blank.
"There was time to kill, so I gave him a thumbnail sketch of the life and times of Count Dracula."
He looked bemused and appalled, but his hand carried on with its machinations, having now moved under my buckskin shirt and found its way beneath the sark as well. His fingers were chilly, but I didn't mind.
"Some people find the notion terribly erotic," I ended.
"That's the most disgusting thing I've ever heard."
"I don't care,"
I said, stretching out full length beside him and putting my head back, throat invitingly exposed.
"Do it some more."
He muttered something under his breath in Gaelic, but managed to get onto one elbow and rolled toward me. His mouth was warm and soft, and whether he approved of what he was doing or not, he did it awfully well.
"Oh," I said, and shuddered ecstatically as his teeth sank delicately into my earlobe.
"Oh, well, if it's like that," he said in resignation,
and taking my hand, pressed it firmly between his thighs.
"Gracious," I said, "and here I thought the cold..."
"It'll be warm enough soon," he assured me. "Get them off, aye."
It was rather awkward, given the cramped quarters, the difficulty of staying covered in order not to suffer frostbite in any exposed portions, and the fact that Jamie was able to lend only the most basic assistance. But we managed quite satisfactorily, nonetheless. What with one thing and another, I was rather preoccupied, though, and it was only during a temporary lull in the activities that I became aware of an uneasy sensation, as though I was being watched. I lifted myself on my hands and glanced out through the screen of hemlock, but saw nothing beyond the grove and the snow-covered slope below. Jamie gave a low groan.
"Don't stop," he murmured, eyes half closed. "What is it?"
"I thought I heard something," I said, lowering myself onto his chest again. At this, I did hear something. A laugh, low but distinct, directly above my head. I rolled off in a tangle of cloaks and discarded buckskins while Jamie cursed and snatched for his pistol. He flung aside the branches with a swoosh, pointing the pistol upward. From the top of the rock above, several heads peered over, all grinning, Ian and four companions from Anauka. The Indians murmured and snickered among themselves, seeming to find something immoderately funny. Jamie laid the pistol down, scowling up at his nephew.
"And what the devil are you doing here, Ian?"
"Why, I was on my way home to keep Christmas with you, Uncle," Ian said, grinning hugely.
Jamie eyed his nephew with marked disfavour.
"Christmas," he said. "Bah, humbug."
The elk carcass had frozen in the night. The sight of ice crystals frosting its blank eyes made me shudder. Not at the sight of death. That was quite beautiful, with the great dark body so still, crusted with snow. But at the thought that had I not yielded to my sense of uneasiness and gone out into the night searching for Jamie, the stark, still life before my eyes might well have been entitled Dead Scotsman in Snow, rather than Frozen Elk with Arguing Indians. The discussion, at last concluded to their satisfaction, Ian informed me that they had decided to return to Anauka, but would see us safely home in return for a share of the elk meat. The carcass hadn't frozen solidly through. They eviscerated it, leaving the cooling entrails in a heap of blue-grey coils splotched with black blood. After chopping off the head to further lessen the weight, two of the men slung the body upside down from a pole, its legs tied together. Jamie eyed them darkly, obviously suspecting that they meant to give him the same treatment. But Ian assured him that they could manage a trois voies. The men were afoot, but they had brought one sturdy pack mule to carry any skins they took. The weather had improved. The snow had melted altogether from the exposed ground, and while the air was still crisp and cold, the sky was a blinding blue, and the forest coldly pungent with the scents of spruce and balsam fir. It was the smell of hemlock as we passed through one grove that reminded me of the beginning of this hegira and the mysterious band of Indians we had seen. "Ian," I said, catching up to him, "just before you and your friends found us on the mountainside, we saw a band of Indians with a Jesuit priest. They weren't from Anauka, I don't think. Do you have any idea who they might have been?"
"Oh, aye, auntie. I ken all about them."
He wiped a mittened hand under his red-tipped nose.
"We were following them when we found you."
The strange Indians, he said, were Mohawk, come from far north. The Tuscarora had been adopted by the Iroquois League some 50 years before, and there was a close association with the Mohawk, with frequent exchanges of visits between the two, both formal and informal. The present visit held elements of both. It was a party of young Mohawk men in search of wives. Their own village, having a shortage of marriageable young women, they had determined to come south to see if suitable mates might be found among the Tuscarora.
"See, a woman must belong to the proper clan," Ian explained. "If she is in the wrong clan, they cannot be married."
"Like MacDonald's and Campbell's, aye?"
Jamie chimed in, interested.
"Aye, a bit," Ian said, grinning. "But that's why they brought the priest with them. If they found women, they could be married at once, and not have to sleep in a cold bed all the way home."
"They're Christians, then?"
Ian shrugged. "Some of them. The Jesuits have been among them for some time, and a good many of the Huron are converts. Not so many among the Mohawk, though."
"So they'd been to Anauka?" I asked, curious. "Why were you and your friends following them?" Ian snorted and tightened the muffler of squirrel skins around his neck.
"They may be allies, auntie, but it doesn't mean a Cognowito and his braves trust them. Even the other nations of the Iroquois League are afraid of the Mohawk, Christian or no."
It was near sunset when we came in sight of the cabin. I was cold and tired, but my heart lifted inexpressibly at the sight of the tiny homestead. One of the mules in the penfold, a light grey creature named Clarence, saw us and brayed enthusiastically in welcome, making the rest of the horses crowd up next to the rails, eager for food.
"The horses looked fine."
Jamie, with a stockman's eye, looked first to the animal's welfare. I was rather more concerned with our own, getting inside, getting warm, and getting fed as soon as possible. We invited Ian's friends to stay, but they declined, unloading Jamie in the doorway and vanishing quickly to resume their vigilance over the departing Mohawk.
"They dinna like to stay in a white person's house, auntie," Ian explained. "They think we smell bad."
"Oh, really?" I said in pique, thinking of a certain elderly gentleman I had met in Anauka, who appeared to have smeared himself with bear grease and then had himself sewn into his clothes for the winter. The pot calling the kettle black, if you asked me. Much later, Christmas properly kept, with a dram or two of whiskey all round, we lay at last in our own bed, watching the flames of the newly kindled fire and listening to Ian's peaceful snores.
"It's good to be home again," I said softly.
"It is."
Jamie sighed and pulled me closer, my head tucked into the curve of his shoulder.
"I did have the strangest dream sleeping in the cold."
"You did?"
I stretched, luxuriating in the soft yielding of the feather-stuffed mattress.
"What did you dream about?"
"All kinds of things."
He sounded a bit shy.
"I dreamt of Brianna now and again."
"Really?"
That was a little startling. I too had dreamt of Brianna in our icy shelter, something I seldom did.
"I did wonder."
Jamie hesitated for a moment.
"Has she a birthmark, Sassenach? And if so, did you tell me of it?"
"She does," I said slowly, thinking.
"I don't think I ever told you about it, though. It isn't visible most of the time, so it's been years since I noticed it myself. It's a..."
His hand, tightening on my shoulder, stopped me.
"It's a wee brown mark, shaped like a diamond," he said. "Just behind her left ear, isn't it?"
"Yes, it is." It was warm and cozy in bed, but a small coolness on the back of my neck made me shiver suddenly. "Did you see that in your dream?"
"I kissed her there,"
he said softly.
Chapter 22. Spark of an Ancient Flame. Oxford, September 1970.
"Oh, Jesus!"
Roger stared at the page in front of him until the letters lost their meaning and became no more than curlicues. No such trick would erase the meaning of the words themselves. Those were already carved into his mind.
"Oh, God, no!"
he said out loud.
The girl in the next carol jerked in irritation at the noise, scraping the legs of her chair against the floor. He leaned over the book, covering it with his forearms, eyes closed. He felt sick, and the palms of his hands were cold and sweaty. He sat that way for several minutes, fighting the truth. It wasn't going to go away, though. Christ, it had already happened, hadn't it? A long time ago, and you couldn't change the past. Finally, he swallowed the taste of bile at the back of his throat and looked again. It was still there. A small notice from a newspaper printed on February the 13th, 1776, in the American colony of North Carolina, in the town of Wilmington. It is with grief that the news is received of the deaths by fire of James Mackenzie Fraser and his wife Claire Fraser in a conflagration that destroyed their house in the settlement of Fraser's Ridge on the night of January the 21st last. Mr. Fraser, a nephew of the late Hector Cameron of River Run Plantation, was born at Brochturach in Scotland. He was widely known in the colony and deeply respected. He leaves no surviving children.
Except that he did.
Roger grasped for a moment at the dim hope that it wasn't them. There were, after all, any number of James Frasers. It was a fairly common name. But not James Mackenzie Fraser. Not with a wife named Claire. Not born in Brochturach, Scotland. No, it was them. The sick certainty filled his chest and squeezed his throat with grief. His eyes stung, and the ornate 18th century typeface blurred again. So she had found him, Claire. Found her gallant Highlander, and enjoyed at least a few years with him. He hoped they had been good years. He had liked Claire Randall very much. No, that was to damn her with faint praise. If he were truthful, he had loved her, and for her own sake as well as her daughter's. More than that, he had wanted badly for her to find Jamie Fraser, to live happily ever after with him. The knowledge, or more accurately, the hope that she had done so, had been a small talisman to him, a witness that enduring love was possible. A love strong enough to withstand separation and hardship, strong enough to outlast time. Yet all flesh was mortal. No love could outlast that fact. He gripped the edge of the table, trying to get himself under control. Foolish, he told himself, thoroughly foolish. And yet he felt as bereft as he had when the Reverend had died, as though he were himself newly orphaned. Realization came as a fresh blow. He couldn't show this to Bree. He couldn't. She'd known the risk, of course, but no. She wouldn't have imagined anything like this. It was the purest chance that had led him to find it. He'd been looking for the lyrics of old ballads to add to his repertoire, thumbing through a book of country songs. An illustration had shown the original newspaper page on which one ballad had first been published, and Roger, idly browsing, had glanced at the archaic notices posted on the same newspaper page, his eye caught by the name Fraser. The shock was beginning to wear off a little, though grief had settled in the pit of his stomach, nagging as the pain of an ulcer. He was a scholar, and the son of a scholar. He had grown up surrounded by books, imbued since childhood with the sanctity of the printed word. He felt like a murderer as he groped for his penknife and stealthily opened it, glancing around to be sure he was unobserved. It was instinct more than reason, the instinct that leads a man to want to clear up the remains of an accident, to lay a decent covering over the bodies, to obliterate the visible traces of disaster, even though the tragedy itself remains. With the folded page lying hidden in his pocket like a severed thumb, he left the library to walk the rainy streets of Oxford. The walking calmed him, made it possible to think rationally again, to force his own feelings back long enough to plan what he must do, how to protect Brianna from a grief that would be more profound and longer felt than his own. He had checked the bibliographic information in the front of the book, published in 1906 by a small British press. It wouldn't be widely available then, but it was still something Brianna might stumble over in her own researches.
It wasn't a logical place to look for information of the sort she was seeking, but the book was titled Songs and Ballads of the 18th Century. He knew well enough that historians' curiosity that led to impulsive pokings in unlikely places. She would know enough to do that too. Still more, he knew the child's hunger for knowledge, any knowledge, that might lead her to look at anything dealing with the period, in an effort to imagine her parents' surroundings, to build a vision of lives she could neither see nor share. Long odds, but not enough. Someone jostled him in passing, and he realized that he'd been leaning on the bridge railing for several minutes, watching raindrops patter on the surface of the river without seeing them. Slowly, he turned down the street, oblivious of the shops and the mushroom herds of umbrellas. There was no way to ensure that she would never see a copy of that book. This might be the only copy, or there might be hundreds lying like time bombs in libraries all over the United States. The ache in his guts was getting worse. He was soaked through by now and freezing. Inside, he felt a deeper cold spreading from a new thought. What might Brianna do if she found out? She would be devastated, grief-stricken. But then? He was himself convinced that the past couldn't be changed. The things Claire had told him had made sure of it. She and Jamie Fraser had tried to avert the slaughter at Culloden, to no avail. She had tried to save her future husband, Frank, by saving his ancestor, Jack Randall, and failed, only to find that Jack had never been Frank's ancestor after all, but had married his younger brother's pregnant lover in order to legitimize the child when the brother died. No, the past might twist on itself like a writhing snake, but it couldn't be changed. He wasn't at all sure that Brianna shared his conviction, though. "How do you mourn a time traveller?" she'd asked him. If he showed her the notice, she could mourn truly. She would know. The knowledge would wound her terribly, but she would heal and could put the past behind her. If. If it wasn't for the stones on Craigna Dun. The stone circle and its dreadful promise of possibility. Claire had gone through the stones of Craigna Dun on the ancient fire feast of Samhain on the first day of November, nearly 2 years before. Roger shivered, and not from the cold. The hair stood up on the back of his neck whenever he thought of it. It had been a clear, mild fall morning, that dawn of the Feast of All Saints, with nothing to disturb the grassy piece of the hill where the circle of stones stood sentinel. Nothing until Claire had touched the great cleft stone and vanished into the past. Then the earth had seemed to dissolve under his own feet, and the air had ripped away with a roar that echoed inside his head like cannon fire. He had gone blind in a blast of light and dark. Only his memories of the last time had kept him from utter panic. He'd had hold of Brianna's hand. Reflex closed his grip, even as all senses disappeared. It was like being dropped from 1,000 feet into ice-cold water. Terrible vertigo, and a shock so intense he could feel no sensation but the shock itself. Blind and deaf, bereft of sense and senses, he'd been conscious of 2 last thoughts, the remnants of his consciousness flicking out like a candle flame in a hurricane. "I'm dying," he had thought, with great calmness, and then, "don't let go." The dawning sun had fallen in a bright path through the cleft stone. Claire had walked along it. When Roger stirred at last and raised his head, the sun of late afternoon glowed gold and lavender behind the great stone, leaving it black against the sky. He was lying on Brianna, sheltering her with his body. She was unconscious but breathing, her face desperately pale against the dark red of her hair. Weak as he was, there was no question of his being able to carry her down the steep hillside to the car below. Her father's daughter, she was nearly 6 feet tall, only a few inches shorter than Roger himself. He had huddled over her, holding her head in his lap, stroking her face and shivering until just before sunset. She had opened her eyes then, as dark a blue as the fading sky, and whispered, "She's gone."
"It's all right,"
Roger had whispered back. He bent and kissed her cold forehead.
"It's all right. I'll take care of you."
He'd meant it.
But how?
It was getting dark by the time he returned to his rooms. He could hear a clatter from the dining hall as he passed, and he smelled boiled ham and baked beans. But supper was the furthest thing from his mind. He squelched up to his rooms and dropped his wet things in a heap on the floor. He dried himself, then sat naked on the bed, towel forgotten in his hand, staring at the desk and at the wooden box that held Brianna's letters. He would do anything to save her from grief. He would do much more to save her from the threat of the stones. Claire had gone back, he hoped, from 1968 to 1766, and then died in 1776. Now it was 1970. A person going back now would, might, end in 1768. There would be time. That was the hell of it. There would be time. Even if Brianna thought as he did, or if he could convince her that the past couldn't be changed, could she live through the next 7 years knowing that the window of opportunity was closing, that her only chance ever to know her father, see her mother again, was disappearing day by day? It was one thing to let them go, not knowing where they were or what had happened to them. It was another to know explicitly and to do nothing. He had known Brianna for more than 2 years, yet been with her for only a few months of that time. And yet they knew each other very well in some respects. How could they not, having shared such an experience? Then there had been the letters, dozens, two or three or four each week, and the rare brief holidays spent between enchantment and frustration that left him aching with need of her. Yes, he knew her. She was quiet, but possessed of a fierce determination that he thought wouldn't submit to grief without a fight. And while she was cautious, once her mind was made up, she acted with hair-raising dispatch. If she decided to risk the passage, he couldn't stop her. His hands closed tight on the wadded towel and his stomach dropped, remembering the chasm of the circle and the void that had nearly swallowed them. The only thing more terrifying was the thought of losing Brianna before he had ever truly had her. He'd never lied to her, but the impact of shock and grief was slowly receding as the rudiments of a plan formed in his mind. He stood up and wrapped the towel around his waist. One letter wouldn't do it. It would have to be slow, a process of suggestion, of gentle discouragement. He thought it wouldn't be difficult. He had found almost nothing in a year of searching in Scotland beyond the report of the burning of Fraser's print shop in Edinburgh. He shuddered involuntarily at the thought of flames. Now he knew why, of course. They must have emigrated soon after, though he had found no trace of them on the ship's rolls he had searched. "Time to give up," he would suggest. "Let the past rest, and the dead bury the dead." To keep on looking in the face of no evidence would border on obsession. He would suggest, very subtly, that it was unhealthy, this looking back. Now it was time to look forward, lest she waste her life in futile searching. Neither of her parents would have wanted that. The room was chilly, but he barely noticed.
"I'll take care of you," he'd said,
and meant it. Was suppressing a dangerous truth the same as lying? Well, if it was, then he'd lie. To give consent to do wrong was a sin. He'd heard that from his early days. That was all right. He'd risk his soul for her, and willingly. He rummaged in the drawer for a pen. Then he stopped, bent, and reached two fingers into the pocket of his sopping jeans. The paper was frayed and soggy, half disintegrating already. With steady fingers he tore it into tiny pieces, disregarding the cold sweat that ran in trickles from his face. Chapter 23. The Skull Beneath the Skin. I had told Jamie that I didn't mind being far from civilization, Wherever there were people, there would be work for a healer. Duncan had been as good as his word, returning in the spring of 1768 with 8 former Ardsmuir men and their families, ready to take up homesteading on Fraser's Ridge, as the place was now known. With some 30 souls to hand, there was an immediate call on my mildly rusty services to stitch up wounds and treat fevers, to lance abscessed boils and scrape infected gums. Two of the women were pregnant, and it was my joy to deliver healthy children, a boy and a girl, both born in early spring. My fame, if that's the word, as a healer, soon spread outside our tiny settlement, and I found myself called farther and farther afield to tend the ills of folk on isolated hill farms scattered over 30 miles of wild mountain terrain. In addition, I made rare visits with Ian to Ana Uka to see Nyawenni, returning with baskets and jars of useful herbs. At first, Jamie had insisted that he or Ian must go with me to the farther places, but it was soon apparent that neither of them could be spared. It was time for the first planting, with ground to break and harrow, corn and barley to be planted, to say nothing of the usual chores required to keep a small farm running. In addition to the horses and mules, we had acquired a small flock of chickens, a depraved-looking black boar to meet the social needs of the pig, and, luxury of luxuries, a milch goat, all of whom required to be fed and watered and generally kept from killing themselves or being eaten by bears or panthers. So, more and more often, I went alone when some stranger appeared suddenly in the dooryard asking for healer or midwife. Daniel Rawling's casebook began to acquire new entries, and the larder was enriched by the gifts of hams and venison haunches, bags of grain, and bushels of apples with which my patients repaid my attentions. I never asked for payment, but something was always offered, and poor as we were, anything at all was welcome. My backcountry patients came from many places, and many spoke neither English nor French. There were German Lutherans, Quakers, Scots, and Scotch-Irish, and a large settlement of Moravian brethren at Salem, who spoke a peculiar dialect of what I thought was Czechoslovakian. I usually managed, though. In most cases, someone could interpret for me, and at the worst, I could fall back on the language of hand and body. Where does it hurt is easy to understand in any tongue. August 1768. I was chilled to the bone. Despite my best efforts to keep the cloak wrapped tightly round me, the wind ripped it from my body and sent it billowing like sail canvas. It beat round the head of the boy walking next to me and jerked me sideways in my saddle with the force of the gale. The rain drove in beneath the flapping folds like frozen needles, and I was soaked through gown and petticoats before we reached Mueller's Creek. The creek itself was boiling past, uprooted saplings, rocks and drowned branches bubbling briefly to the surface. Tommy Mueller peered at the torrent, shoulders hunched nearly to the brim of the slouch hat he wore pulled down over his ears. I could see doubt etched in every line of his body, and bent close to shout in his ear. "Stay here!" I bellowed, pitching my voice below the shriek of the wind. He shook his head, mouthing something at me, but I couldn't hear. I shook my own head vigorously and pointed up the bank. The muddy soil was crumbly here. I could see small chunks of the black dirt melt away even as I watched. "Get back!" I shouted. He pointed emphatically himself, back in the direction of the farmhouse, and reached for my reins. Clearly he thought it was too dangerous. He wanted me to come back to the house to wait out the storm. He definitely had a point. On the other hand, I could see the stream widening even as I watched, the ravenous water eating away the soft bank in gobbets and chunks. Wait much longer, and no one could cross. Neither would it be safe for days after. Floods like this kept the water high for as long as a week, as the rains from higher up the mountain trickled down to feed the torrents. The thought of being cooped up in a four-room house for a week with all 10 Muellers was enough to spur me to recklessness. Pulling the reins from Tommy's grasp, I wheeled about, the horse tossing its head against the rein, stepping carefully on the slick mud. We reached the upper slopes of the bank, where a layer of thick dead leaves gave better footing. I turned the horse, motioned Tommy back out of the way, and leaned forward like a steeplechaser, elbows digging into the bag of barley bound over the saddle in front of me, my payment for services rendered. The shift of my weight was enough. The horse was no more anxious to hang about here than I was. I felt the sudden thrust as the hindquarters dropped and bunched, and then we were flying down the slope like a runaway toboggan. A jolt and a moment of giddy freefall, then a resounding splash, and I was up past my thighs in freezing water. My hands were so cold they might as well have been welded to the reins, but I had nothing useful to offer in terms of guidance. I let my arms go slack, giving the horse his head. I could feel huge muscles moving rhythmically under my legs as it swam, and the even more powerful shove of the water rushing past us. It dragged at my skirts, threatening to pull me off into the surge. Then came the jar and scrabble of hooves against the stream bottom, and we were out, pouring water like a colander. I turned in the saddle to see Tommy Mueller on the other side, his jaw hanging open under his hat. I couldn't let go of the reins to wave, but bowed toward him ceremoniously, then nudged the horse with my heels, and turned toward home. The hood of my cloak had fallen back when we jumped, but it made no great difference. I couldn't get much wetter. I knuckled a wet strand of hair out of my eyes and turned the horse's head toward the upland trail, relieved to be headed home, rain or no. I had been at the Müller's cabin for 3 days, seeing 18-year-old Petronella through her first labour. It would be her last, too, according to Petronella. Her 17-year-old husband, peeking tentatively into the room in the middle of the second day, had received a burst of German invective from Petronella that had sent him stumping back to the men's refuge in the barn, ears bright red with mortification. Still, a few hours later, I had seen Freddy, looking much younger than 17, kneel tentatively by his wife's bedside, face whiter than her shift, as he reached a hesitant, scrubbed finger to push aside the blanket covering his daughter. He stared dumbly at the rounded head, furred with soft black, then looked at his wife as though in need of prompting.
"Ist sie nicht wunderschön?" Petronella said softly.
He nodded slowly, then laid his head on her lap and began to cry. The women had all smiled kindly and gone back to fixing dinner. It had been a good dinner, too. The food was one of the benefits of house calls to the Müllers. Even now my stomach was comfortably distended with dumplings and fried blutwurst, and the lingering taste of buttered eggs in my mouth provided some small distraction from the general discomfort of my present situation. I hoped that Jamie and Ian had managed something adequate to eat in my absence. This being the end of summer, but not yet harvest time, the pantry shelves were nowhere near the height of what I hoped would be their autumn bounty. But still there were cheeses on the shelf, a huge stoneware crock of salted fish on the floor, and sacks of flour, corn, rice, beans, barley, and oatmeal. Jamie could, in fact, cook, at least so far as dressing game and roasting it over a fire, and I'd done my best to initiate Ian into the mysteries of making oatmeal porridge, but they, being men, I suspected that they hadn't bothered, choosing instead to survive on raw onions and dried meat. I couldn't tell whether it was simply that after a day spent in the manly pursuits of chopping down trees, ploughing fields, and carrying deer carcasses over mountains, they honestly were too exhausted to think of assembling a proper meal, or whether they did it on purpose, so that I would feel necessary. The wind had dropped now that I was in the shelter of the ridge, but the rain was still pelting down, and the footing was treacherous as the mud of the trail had liquefied, leaving a layer of fallen leaves floating on top, deceptive as quicksand. I could feel the horse's discomfort as its hooves slipped with each step.
"Good boy," I said soothingly. "Keep it up. That's a good fellow."
The horse's ears pricked slightly, but he kept his head down, stepping carefully.
"Slewfoot," I said. "How's that?"
The horse had no name at the moment.
Or rather, he did, but I didn't know what it was. The man from whom Jamie had bought him had called him by a German word that Jamie said was not at all suitable for a lady's horse. When I'd asked him to translate the word, he had merely compressed his lips and looked Scottish, from which I deduced that it must be pretty bad. I'd meant to ask old Mrs. Mueller what it meant, but had forgotten in the haste of leaving. In any case, Jamie's theory was that the horse would reveal his true, or at least speakable, name in the course of time, so we were all watching the animal in hopes of discerning its character. On the basis of a trial ride, Ian had suggested Coney, but Jamie had merely shaken his head and said, no, that wasn't it. Twinkletoes, I suggested. Lightfoot? Damn! The horse had come to a full stop for obvious reasons. A small freshet gurgled merrily down the hill, bounding from rock to rock with gay abandon. It was beautiful, the rushing water clear as crystal over dark rock and green leaves. Unfortunately, it was also bounding over the remains of the trail, which, unequal to the force of events, had slithered off the face of the hill into the valley below. I sat still, dripping. There wasn't any way around. The hill rose nearly perpendicularly on my right, shrubs and saplings poking out of a cracked rock face, and declined so precipitously to the left that going down would have amounted to suicide. Swearing under my breath, I backed the nameless horse and turned around. If it hadn't been for the flooded creek, I would have gone back to the Mueller's and let Jamie and Ian fend for themselves a bit longer. As it was, I had no choice. It was find another way home, or stay here and drown. Wearily, we retraced our slogging steps. Less than a quarter mile from the washout, though, I found a spot where the hillside fell away into a small saddle, a depression between two horns of granite. Such formations were common. There was a big one on a nearby mountain which had gained it the name of Devil's Peak. If I could cross the saddle to the other side of the hill and pick my way along it, I would in time come back to the trail where it crossed the ridge to the south. From the saddle, I had a momentary clear view of the foothills and the blue hollow of the valley beyond. On the other side, though, clouds hid the tops of the mountains, black with rain, suffused with an occasional flicker of hidden lightning. The wind had dropped now that the leading edge of the storm had passed. The rain was coming down even more heavily, if such a thing was possible, and I stopped long enough to pry my cold fingers off the reins and put up the hood of my cloak. The footing on this side of the hill was fair, the ground being rocky but not too steep. We picked our way through small groves of red-berried mountain ash and larger stands of oak. I noted the location of a huge blackberry bramble for future reference, but didn't stop. I would be lucky to get home by dark as it was. To distract myself from the cold trickles running down my neck, I began a mental inventory of the pantry. What could I make for dinner once I arrived? Something quick, I thought, shivering, and something hot. Stew would take too long, so would soup. If there was squirrel or rabbit, we might have it fried, rolled in egg and cornmeal batter. Or, if not that, perhaps brose with a little bacon for flavouring, and a couple of scrambled eggs with green onions. I ducked, wincing. Despite the hood and the thickness of my hair, the raindrops were beating on my scalp like hail pellets. Then I realized that they were hail pellets. Tiny white spheres pinged off the horse's back and rattled through the oak leaves. Within seconds, the pellets were bigger, the size of marbles, and the hail had grown heavy enough that its popping sounded like machine gun fire on the wet mats of leaves in the clearings. The horse flung up its head, shaking its mane vigorously in an effort to escape the stinging pellets. Hastily, I reined in and guided it into the semi-shelter of a huge chestnut tree. Underneath, it was noisy, but the hail slid off the thick canopy of leaves, leaving us protected. "Right," I said. With some difficulty, I pried one hand off the reins and gave the horse a reassuring pat. "Easy, then. We'll be all right as long as we don't get struck by lightning." Evidently, this statement had jogged someone's memory.
A silent fork of dazzling light split the black sky beyond Roan Mountain. A few moments later, the dull rumble of thunder came booming up the hollow, drowning out the rasp of hail on the leaves overhead. Sheet lightning shimmered far away across the mountains. Then more bolts, sizzling across the sky, each succeeded by a louder roll of thunder. The hailstorm passed, and the rain resumed, pelting down as hard as ever. The valley below disappeared in cloud and mist, but the lightning lit the stark mountain ridges like bones on an X-ray.
1 hippopotamus, 2 hippopotamus, 3 hippopotamus, 4 hippopot... Boom!
The horse jerked its head and stamped nervously.
I know just how you feel, I told it, peering down the valley. Steady, though. Steady.
There it went again. A flash that lit the dark ridge and left the silhouette of the horse's pricked ears imprinted on my retinas.
1 hippopotamus, 2 hippo...
I could have sworn the ground shook. The horse let out a high-pitched scream and reared against my pull on the reins, hooves thrashing in the leaves. The air reeked of ozone.
Flash! 1, I said through my teeth. Damn you! Whoa! 1 hip... Flash! 1 flash. Whoa! Whoa!
I wasn't conscious of the fall at all, nor even the landing. One moment I was sawing at the reins, 1,000 pounds of panicked horse going to pieces under me, shying in all directions. The next, I was lying on my back, blinking up at a spinning black sky, trying to will my diaphragm to work. Echoes of the shock of impact wavered through my flesh, and I tried frantically to fit myself back into my body.
Then I drew breath, a painful gasp, and found myself shaking, the shock turning to the first intimations of damage.
I lay still, eyes closed, concentrating on breathing, conducting an inventory. The rain was still pounding down onto my face, puddling in my eye sockets and running down into my ears. My face and hands were numb. My arms moved. I could breathe a little easier now. My legs. The left one hurt, but not in any threatening way, only a bruised knee. I rolled heavily onto my side, impeded by my wet, bulky garments. Still, it was the heavy clothing that had saved me from serious damage. Above me came an uncertain whinny, audible amid the booming thunder. I looked up, dizzy, and saw the horse's head protruding from a thicket of buckbrush some 30 feet overhead. Below the thicket, a steep, rocky slope fell away. A long, straight mark toward the bottom showed where I had struck and rolled before ending up in my present position. We had been standing virtually on the edge of this small precipice without my seeing it, screened as it was by the heavy growth of shrubs. The horse's panic had sent it to the edge, but evidently it had sensed the danger and caught itself before going over. Not before letting me slide off into space, though.
"You bloody bugger," I said,
and wondered whether the unknown German name meant something similar.
"I could have broken my neck!"
I wiped the mud from my face with a hand that still shook and looked about me for a way back up. There wasn't one. Behind me the rocky cliff face continued, merging into one of the granite horns. Before me it ended abruptly in a plunge straight downward into a small hollow. The slope I stood on declined into this hollow as well, rolling down through clumps of yellow wood and sumac to the banks of a small creek some 60 feet below. I stood quite still, trying to think. No one knew where I was. I didn't know exactly where I was, come to that. Worse, no one would be looking for me for some time. Jamie would think I was still at Müller's because of the rain. The Müllers would, of course, have no reason to think I hadn't made it safely home. Even if they had doubts, they couldn't follow me, because of the flooded creek. And by the time anyone found the washed-out trail, any traces of my passage would long since have been obliterated by the rain. I was uninjured. That was something. I was also afoot, alone, without food, moderately lost, and thoroughly wet. About the only certainty was that I wasn't going to die of thirst. The lightning was still glancing to and fro like dueling pitchforks in the sky above, though the thunder had faded to a dull rumble in the distance. I had no particular fear of being struck by lightning now, not with so many better candidates standing about in the form of